From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. What lies ahead for America's war in Iraq? Well, yesterday, General David Petraeus took the mic at hearings on Capitol Hill. He described the situation on the ground as a fragile and reversible progress. General Petraeus said that 20,000 servicemen and women will return home by July. After that withdrawal, he recommended temporarily halting more troop drawdowns. Because the three leading contenders in the presidential race are senators, they each had opportunities to quiz the general. In his opening remarks, Senator John McCain said that he believes a complete withdrawal is eventually possible.
I believe we can achieve that goal perhaps sooner than many imagine. But I also believe that the promise of withdrawal of our forces, regardless of the consequences, would constitute a failure of political and moral leadership.
To discuss the hearings and other political news, we're joined by Donna Brazile, Democratic strategist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, and Robert Trainum, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8. Welcome.
Hello.
So after months of reduced violence, there's been an upswing in attacks in Iraq, particularly near Basra. The senators had plenty of questions on Capitol Hill, and here is Senator Clinton quizzing the general.
So how are we to judge General Petraeus? What the conditions are or should be, and the actions that you and the administration would recommend pursuing based on them?
With respect to the conditions, Senator, what we have is a number of factors that we will consider by area.
Now, how did the senators frame their approach to these hearings? I'm going to ask you first, Donna.
Well, first of all, I think Senator John McCain used his line of question, if you look at it, to, again, reinforce the message that the United States should stay in Iraq, that it would be unwise to set a timetable for an exit. Senator Clinton used her time to question the effectiveness of the surge and whether or not any political progress clearly have been made. And Senator Obama used his line of questioning to once again point out that perhaps the United States should be focusing its efforts in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where Al-Qaeda is, has assembled on the Afghanistan border. And he tried to get Ambassador Crocker, as well as General Petraeus, to acknowledge that Al-Qaeda is a greater threat in that part of the world rather than in Iraq. So I think they all used the hearing to reinforce their general positioning on Iraq, with both Senator Clinton as well as Senator Obama believing that it's time for us to begin to bring our troops home. And Senator McCain used his time to reinforce that we should stay there as long as needed. And, again, Senator Levin and others who are not running for president question whether or not the United States should continue to spend billions of our dollars while the Iraqi government now has over $300 billion in surplus, and perhaps it's time for them to begin to spend their own money.
Along those lines, when you think about, Robert, some of the jockeying that there's been over national security as an issue and contrasting our national security needs with some of the other needs this country has right now, do you think that anyone was a winner yesterday among these three candidates in terms of really getting their message out, or did all of them do fairly well in just sort of trying to look smart on Capitol Hill, which is a task in and of itself?
You're exactly right, Farai. Look, I mean, everyone used this as a platform to advance their own personal opinions or feelings or whatever you want to call it as it relates to the war in Iraq and also in Afghanistan. What I found very interesting about the questioning yesterday, Farai, is that not only was it civil, but also it was pretty intellectually challenging for the most part. I mean, all the senators, even the ones that are not running for president, made their points and made them very, very clearly. They strongly disagreed and or agreed with the administration on particular policy. But even more importantly, and I hate to say this, but I think I'm right here, is that General Petraeus was almost he was almost just like a prop on this massive stage. And the reason why is because Senators McCain, Obama, and Clinton were not necessarily speaking to to General Petraeus. They were actually speaking to the American people through General Petraeus to augment whatever they feel about the Iraq war. Senator McCain made his points and made them very, very well, as well as Senator Obama and Clinton. I actually thought Senator Clinton's comments were much more less divisive as they were in the past. Remember when General Petraeus was up on Capitol Hill in the summertime, it was very bombastic. It was very combative. It was almost like, how dare you sit here and lie to me? Because the facts that you are portraying, General Petraeus, are not the facts that we're seeing on the television screens and that we're listening on NPR. So yesterday was very, very interesting, and it was a complete 360, if you will, as opposed to the line of questioning come, 6 months ago.
Well, let's move on to some other presidential campaign news. Hillary Clinton's chief campaign strategist, Mark Pence, stepped down over the weekend. As part of his duties at a private firm, he was part of a meeting, scheduled meeting with Colombian officials to discuss a free trade pact. The problem was that Senator Clinton opposes that deal. So, Donna, could this hurt Senator Clinton in the upcoming Pennsylvania primary because the whole issue of free trade and NAFTA has been such a thorn in the side of some voters?
I think so, only because it's a distraction. Senator Clinton opposes the free trade pact with Colombia. She has disagreements with the NAFTA trade deal as well that she was involved with, or her husband, of course, supported back in the 1990s. Former President Bill Clinton supports the Colombia Free Trade Act. That's also a little bit of a difficulty for her. And Mark Penn is still involved in the campaign, not as chief strategist, but as a his company is still doing polling and as well as doing the mail. So I think you will find some of the labor unions taking issue with Senator Clinton for keeping Mark Penn on the payroll, so to speak, although it's not Mark Penn personally, it's his firm. His firms have been paid over $10 million thus far in delivering various services to the Clinton campaign. And to the extent that he's still at the table, although not at the head of the table, he becomes a campaign issue.
Robert, a friend of mine who is working on one of the campaigns said that your whole goal is to keep the campaign staff out of the news. Is this hurtful mainly in the sense that Donna says of being a distraction from the message?
Yes. I mean, look, this is just yet another hiccup in a long road of hiccups. First, you had Patty Solis Doyle, who was the first campaign manager for Senator Clinton. You also had some surrogates out there on both sides, on Senator Obama's side and also on Senator Clinton's side, making some unfortunate remarks. And now you have Mark Penn. Look, the average person out there does not know who Mark Penn is, nor do they care. But what they do care about is the Colombian Free Trade Agreement. They care about gas prices. They care about health care. They care about the direction of this country. And, of course, they care about Iraq. So I think we should put this into perspective. The average person out there probably doesn't care about Mark Penn, doesn't really care about whether he's on payroll or not. But again, they care about the overall direction of Senator Clinton's campaign. And if, in fact, she's projecting this image, if you will, of someone that is looking out for their best interest. And again, this is something that is a hiccup. Will it be the nail in the coffin for Senator Clinton's campaign? Probably not. But again, this is the last thing that she needs.
We're going to make a run at this later in the show on our Bloggers Roundtable, but I want to give you guys a quick crack at Condoleezza Rice. Senator McCain is putting together his short list of vice presidential candidates, and Condoleezza Rice has been variously portrayed as seeking it and not seeking it. What do you think, Donna?
First of all, she's not seeking it. She's not interested. She has indicated on numerous occasions that she is returning to California, returning to Stanford, returning to academic life. I think Condoleezza Rice is a little bit tired of Washington, D.C. at this point in terms of when her service is over with at the end of President Bush's term. She hopes to return to private life again.
What do you think, Robert?
Donna's exactly right. Secretary Rice is not even remotely interested in retail politics. She is a foreign policy geek, and I say that with all the tongue-in-cheek and love that she is deserving of. She wants to go back to California. This is a bunch of individuals in Washington, D.C., Dan Senor and some other folks that are sitting around a table trying to come up with a dream ticket for Senator McCain because they pretty much recognize that as of right now, there's a 99.9% chance that there is going to be a minority at the head of the ticket on the Democratic side, whether it be Senator Clinton or Senator Obama. So what Republicans want, they desperately want, is diversity on their side as well. And since Senator McCain is a bit older, he's 71 years old, he'll be 72 if in fact he's elected and inaugurated, they, meaning the McCain camp, recognize that they need someone young, fresh, dynamic, preferably a woman, preferably an African-American. And, of course, on the Republican side, when you put those criteria out there, the pickings are kind of slim. So, of course, well, naturally, Condoleezza Rice would be at the top of that list.
Well, I'm going to ask
Donna,
you that.
Don't laugh, Donna.
I'm laughing because Condoleezza Rice has enough gravitas and experience to head the ticket in 2012 because I don't believe Senator McCain will win. So she should, if she's interested in serving, she should wait until 2012, Robert, and hire you to run her campaign.
Well, Robert,
well, I'm not running your...
who else is there? I mean, you mentioned, I mean, I'm sure it's highly debatable whether or not they're looking specifically for an African-American, the Republican Party, that is. But who else is out there? You know, some people, for example, have talked about Prescott Bush being a future candidate. He is of Latino heritage of the Bush family, Jeb Bush's son. But who, you know, who have we got right now?
Well, let's just look at the numbers here. And what the numbers dictate is that there are only just a few people out there that actually can help the ticket come November. That is Charlie Crist, who is the current governor of Florida. That is Governor Pawlenty, the current governor of Minnesota. You also have a couple of senators out there, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. There's some talk of Tom Ridge, who is the former governor of Pennsylvania. So, you know, Senator McCain has a very, very small list of people that he actually would help him on the ticket. And what he needs to do and what he's doing is sitting down, taking a deep breath, telling everyone to relax, and says, you know what, this process will work itself out. We have months before we go to Minneapolis, meaning the Republicans going to the convention, and we will find the best candidate that, God forbid, if I was to die, to assume the presidency, if in fact it comes to that. So the list is very, very small. And you're speaking of George Prescott Bush, who is current President Bush's nephew, who obviously is not qualified to be the vice presidential nominee right now. There are a lot of social conservatives out there, Farai, that would love for Jeb Bush to become the vice presidential nominee, who is the former governor of Florida. But because of his last name Bush, I'm not exactly sure the American people can tolerate another Bush at the top of the ticket right now.
All right. Amen. On that note.
Amen. Amen.
Well, Donna and Robert, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Farai.
Robert Tranum is the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. He joined us from WHYY in Philadelphia. And Donna Brazile is a Democratic strategist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Will Smith, Denzel Washington, or Terrence Howard? Just who should play Barack Obama when his life story hits the big screen? You've been telling us who you want to see on our blog, News and Views, and here to fill us in is News and Notes web producer Jeffrey Bennett. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Farai.
So you did a really amazing layout. If folks haven't seen this yet, you've got to, of all the cast of characters in the Obama story and, you know, the actors that you thought could play them. How people responded and what have they tossed back?
They've tossed back a really impressive cast, actually. We read that Tyler Perry was going to work on the life story of Michelle Obama, so we took it a step further and thought, well, if there's going to be this Barack Obama biopic, who should play in it? So as Michelle Obama, we said Regina King. One of our readers thought Angela Bassett, but not so much. We're sticking with Regina King. As Hillary Clinton, we said Meredith Baxter, just based on the resemblance alone. Our readers suggested Meryl Streep, Candace Bergen, or Kathleen Turner. And as Barack, we initially said Will Smith, but we've changed our minds. We now support and endorse Harry Lennox to play Barack Obama life story.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing feature. So let's talk about the people who make money talking about the candidates. There was an interesting conversation on our blog this week about the diversity of television political pundits.
Yeah, exactly. And we took that story from the New York Times and talked about that. It was about how political watchers like Donna Brazile, Michelle Bernard, Roland Martin, and Jamal Simmons, some of the people who are regulars on our show, are getting more attention and airtime on the cable network. So the Times asked whether such moves signal real progress or merely reflect the needs of a particular news cycle. And most people on our blog were, you know, welcomed the addition of more black faces on TV. But one reader, Muji Odorinde, took issue with the characterization, saying, "I don't think anyone should cheapen the accomplishments of these black pundits just based on who's running in the election." So.
And what else is getting attention on News and Views?
Lots of things. Our reporting yesterday on the cash-strapped states who are considering, which are considering the early release of prisoners. Condi Rice floated as a potential running mate for John McCain, as we've talked about, and protests surrounding the Olympic Games in China. And next week, our show will broadcast from Atlanta, so we're looking
Woo-hoo!
For people. I know, right? Atlanta, the mighty ATL. So we're looking for people who live in the area, who are familiar with it, who can flag us to stories or people or places that we should focus our attention on while we're there. And they can hit us up on Facebook or on our blog.
And as a Morehouse man, this is a homecoming for you, right?
It is indeed.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me in our studios at NPR West. Now on to our bloggers' roundtable. Is Condoleezza Rice campaigning to be John McCain's running mate? Plus, traditional civil rights organizations struggle to stay relevant as online activism explodes. With us, we've got Arlene Fenton from the blog Black Women Vote, Wayne Hicks, known in the blogosphere as The Villager. He writes the blog Electronic Village, and Jay Anderson of Average Bro. Welcome, folks.
Hi.
Hello.
Welcome.
So, you know, we mentioned earlier in the show that some political insiders are saying that Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice may be interested in being John McCain's running mate. The consensus among our two political experts was probably not, but maybe she could even run solo in 2012. I'm going to keep this one tight. Arlene, what do you think? Is she going to gun for that VP spot?
Not at all. She has no desire at all to be on a ticket. She said it many times. From what I understand, she's going back to Stanford. And I think that's really just coming from a lot of wishful thinkers on the right. But she has expressed many times that she's not interested at all.
Wayne, is this really about just wishing that there was a black person who could fill these shoes on the Republican side?
Yeah, actually, I would be very, very surprised if McCain even wanted her on the ticket. She doesn't bring economic experience that he would need from whoever is his running mate. She's not been in an elective office, which to a certain degree means she hasn't been vetted, you know, for the type of strain that comes with running for an office, much less the presidency. And quite frankly, she's tied very closely to George W. Bush, and he's going to be running away from the concept of being a third Bush term whenever he can. So it didn't make a lot of sense to me from John McCain's point of view.
Jay, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the whole concept of playing racial chess, you know, and basically, you know, throwing Condoleezza Rice out there is really a counter to Barack Obama is maybe a little bit insulting on the surface. And let's just be honest. I mean, if you had to choose a black person, I mean, come on, Condoleezza Rice is not exactly the most popular choice if you were going to add someone to the ticket. I mean, it's not like they're adding Beyonce. I mean, come on, Keisha Cole.
Now that
you could choose some other people, but just overall, I think they were floating the idea out there just to gauge your reaction. I personally don't believe. I think it's still out there. I mean, Dr. Rice, of course, came out with her statement yesterday, but I think we'll see. I mean, when we get to Minneapolis, St. Paul in September, we'll see what happens then.
You're going to send me to Photoshop to make a McCain Beyonce 08 T-shirt.
Got to do that.
Anyway, I want to talk about broader issues of leadership on a more grassroots level. There was a recent Washington Post article asking if civil rights organizations like CORE and the NAACP are passé 40 years after MLK's death. Now, some of these groups like the NAACP have been struggling with money troubles. There's leadership issues. There's aging membership, declining membership. On the other hand, there are these new online outlets like The Color of Change, which has over 400,000 members that try to bundle grassroots younger organizations. And last year, when six black teens in Gina, Louisiana were arrested, The Color of Change helped gather protesters to march in Gina. So the article poses the question, what would happen if W.E.B. Du Bois or Marcus Garvey had a laptop? Jay, what do you think would have happened?
Boy, I mean, imagine the possibilities. I just think overall, if you look at what bloggers are doing and how we're bringing a different voice to the table, a different voice to the conversation, it's amazing. I mean, if you imagine the possibilities of what, say, Dr. King or W.E. Du Bois or anyone, you know, of that era might have been able to do with the technology, with the access to information that we have nowadays.
Arlene, is there something that we give up by doing so much online? I mean, I'm certainly invested in it. We have our blog here. We have a Facebook community. But there is still a difference between grassroots, door-to-door, knocking, meeting people, shaking hands, and e-activism. What are the pros and cons of that approach?
Well, I do think that online activism does create kind of a designer-type activist that excludes a lot of people. There are plenty of people of color who have not yet crossed a digital divide, and that's an issue that a lot of bloggers and online activists need to explore further. So I think that's, you know, one of the drawbacks. One of the good things is, I mean, just the fact that you can spread so much information in a short space of time, the quality of the information is beyond anything that can be done on paper. So I think that the reason that many of these established organizations are struggling is that they've failed to embrace the technology because they already have the brick and mortar. They already have the people who understand who they are, but they've not really embraced the internet like they could have.
Wayne, what are the ways to blend, you know, hybridize this approach? Because, you know, for example, with the Gina Six Color of Change situation, we talked to a young man from Morehouse, and what he did was he found a posting about these protests online, but then he printed it out and went and took it to a bunch of people. So it was a mix of online and face-to-face networking. Do you think that's an approach that's going to really, you know, strengthen the entire question of who gets to mobilize people?
Yeah, online activism can only take you so far because it is, by definition, online. And most of the problems that exist in our world exist in the quote-unquote real world. So you do need to get out into the real world. I would personally love it if organizations that have a tremendous legacy in our community, like the NAACP, the SCLC, Urban League, I would love it if they would embrace the technology. I would love it if National NAACP, instead of having to wait for their quarterly board meeting of 129 people, could indeed be having some online town hall meetings. Could it be using blog technology to get the word out about bills and legislation that we need to call our congresspeople about, et cetera. They just simply don't have the leadership to do it, which is why they become, and the question can be asked, are they obsolete? Are they irrelevant? They don't need to be out there. They need to find ways to work with us. Instead, we too often find ourselves almost at battling one another for no good reason.
You know, when it comes to this issue of what the traditional organization should do, there have been so many different blog posts. One said, if we are to be a truly colorblind society, then these groups should disband. It's up to the federal government to be sure laws are in place to address every civil rights issue. There's always the question of, has the time passed for organizations like the NAACP? And people have a variety of answers. I want to get yours quickly, and I'll run through you. Arlene?
Absolutely not. And first of all, I don't believe in being colorblind. There's nothing wrong with color. It is supposed to be embraced and accepted and respected. And so I really don't see anything wrong with having organizations designed to help a certain group of people, especially if they are suffering some kind of injustice. So, no, I don't think the time is over for those types of organizations.
Wayne?
Absolutely not. We have never had a person of color that served as our president. We only have one person right now that's an African-American that's in the United States Senate. Out of the Fortune 500 companies, there's six black folks that are running a Fortune 500 company. Out of all the governors of all of the 200 years of our existence, we've had four. And so is there still a time for activism by African-American organizations like the NAACP? Absolutely. We just need them to understand that this is no longer the 1960s and the 1970s. We're now into the 21st century and take advantage of our 21st century tools.
Jay?
And Farai, I think we have to be honest and look at these organizations for what they are. I mean, and not expecting more of them than that. The NAACP is a racial justice organization. They are reactive by nature. You know, something happens, they react. They ask people to boycott, they ask people to march, so on and so forth. What I'm hoping is going to happen with the blogosphere, and what I'm hoping we're going to bring to this the table here is, you know, encouraging people to do things proactively. A lot of the problems we have in our community are not things that can be solved with a march. I mean, things like, you know, if you look at the issues with just the achievement gap, for example, I mean, there can't be a march for that. There's not going to be something that happens that garners a reaction that's going to solve that sort of problem. I think overall, we as a people have to stop looking at these organizations to solve our problems, and people have to come in and do their part. I mean, it's really as simple as that. Otherwise, we're going to be having the same conversation 20 years from now. And you're right, the NAACP will be gone. And, you know, if you look at the blogosphere, maybe we'll be looked at as obsolete as well.
I want to go to a specific question of whether or not certain types of activism are harmful. There is the case of the Dunbar Village rape. There was a Haitian immigrant brutally raped by mass teens in these housing projects in West Palm Beach, Florida. Her son was also beaten. Since then, four teens between the ages of 14 and 18 in age were arrested and charged as adults. So last week, Reverend Sharpton showed up in West Palm Beach to denounce the denial of bail to those defendants. He compared them to five white teenage defendants from Boca Raton, Ritzier area, who were accused of raping two middle school girls after drinking on New Year's Eve. Those white teens, who also raped suspects, were granted bail. Now, NAACP activists also protested what they see as the disparate handling of the two cases. Sharpton said the black teens remain jailed while the white teens are free on bond. Is this a question of racial justice, Arlene? Because you have been out in front on this.
Absolutely not. And I was extremely outraged by those movements. And it's very common. And in fact, if these organizations are going obsolete, it's more because of stances like this than their inability to embrace technology. A lot of black folk out there really see a lot of inconsistencies with the types of cases they select. For example, the victim of this crime was a black woman and her black son. And this idea that we must choose the lowest common denominator of white racial justice as our standard to embrace is racist in and of itself. And I think most of us have enough sense to realize when a crime has been committed of this magnitude that you do not go behind and try to release these same suspects into the community that they were locked up to protect. And so, there was a huge groundswell of outrage and motions and of activism against them. And I think it was well deserved.
Now, I'm going to go to you, Wayne. You've written about this. What are, what would you focus on, and what are some of the other bloggers that you've checked out focusing on in terms of this debate between, is this a case of racial justice for the defendants, or who's really looking out for the victim?
And I think the first thing that you do is, as Arlene suggested, you just look at the facts. And in this case, the facts were that the NAACP West Palm Beach branch and Al Sharpton were wrong to have a press release and to stand up with the parents of those defendants, those rapists, and say they should be released because the young white boys had been released in another part of the state. The facts said they were wrong. Therefore, what the blogosphere did, what we did as bloggers, was we went to them behind the scenes, quietly, one-on-one, and said, you're wrong. Please correct the record. Please support the victim in this case. Please do not release and advocate for the release in this case of these four thugs that went out and gang raped this woman and her son. And we didn't get a response. The NAACP stonewalled, Al Sharpton and his group stonewalled. In fact, they tried to say, well, we had something incorrect. And that's when the power of the bloggers got together. And we just quietly, effectively, in places in all four corners of the country, began to tell the story. And Al Sharpton on his radio station recanted it. And well, NAACP recanted it. And that's how this thing works. If folks don't learn to work together and to get the facts right, that it's very difficult to fight against the strength of a blogosphere that has no, real leader. It just is out there, if you will.
Now, I have to point out that they are not yet convicted rapists. They're alleged rapists. But Jay, last word to you quickly. Do you think this is an example of some of the ways in which there is a diversity of opinion in the black community, and it's healthy, or is this potentially destructive?
I think it's healthy, but I think, again, just back to my prior point, we have to move beyond reaction. These kids have committed an atrocity. There are no two ways around that. It's happened. But I wish we in the blogosphere would start focusing our efforts and trying to cultivate our readers to do things that are proactive, to encourage people to go out and tutor and mentor and coach, so that we don't have kids who think they have to do this sort of thing and force a mother to endure this sort of atrocity. I think, again, our focus has to start being towards solutions, not reactions when things happen.
All right. Well, Jay, Wayne, Arlene, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Arlene Fenton from the blog Black Women Vote. She was at the Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia. Wayne Hicks, otherwise known as The Villager, writes the blog Electronic Village, and he was at WGUC in Cincinnati, Ohio. And Jay Anderson's blog is Average Bro. He was at NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Now we pick up on a story we featured yesterday. We looked into plans by some states to expand their early prison release programs and examine the challenges of re-entry into society by former prisoners. Today we've got Judge Lynn Toler. She's going to give us some perspective on what it means to be behind the bench making the judgments that can send people to jail or prison. She now presides on TV's divorce court, and she's also a regular News and Notes contributor. Judge, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. So it's got to be tough to sit there and be the person who says, I'm going to send you to jail. What kind of issues do you consider when you've had to, you know, levy a sentence?
Well, first of all, you have to take care of the legal stuff. You have to make sure you know what kind of crime this is. There's limits on your discretion. And also, they also have sentencing guidelines these days on the federal level, allowing common pleas or court levels, that requires a consistent sentence to be handed down. And if you deviate from that based upon exacerbating or mitigating circumstances, you have to explain why you did that. So you've got to understand that there are a lot of limits on judges that people don't recognize. But within the context of those limitations, you look at who this person is. You usually have sent him to your probation department. They've talked to him about their background. We got to know about his mental health issues. We've got to know about his addiction. We've got to know about his environment. And based upon those things and his past record and the possibilities, his educational level, what would be the appropriate sentence for him? The problem that we have once we've done that is our options are typically fairly limited: to jail or not to jail, put on probation and have a lot of probation conditions, or put him in jail or prison.
There's now more money going to reentry programs, both from the federal level through a bill that the president's signing into law, and from private levels. But is there enough of an array of treatment and, follow-up programs? I mean, in your time looking at this problem from the bench, have you thought, well, we need more of this or we need more of that in order to really make sure that these young men and women don't come back?
No doubt about it. We need more of everything. What the judiciary has turned into is not a place where your unusual individual goes. It's where systemic social problems end up. So you don't have the wherewithal to deal with what if you have an alcoholic going in, or and that's his main problem, that's why he's abusive, or if you have someone who has a drug addiction going in, or once you get in, they go back out to the same community that created the problem to begin with. You have not addressed a problem. You have just simply delayed it till another date. So clearly, I think the judiciary should be seen as a place of last resort more. We need more tools, but also there need to be tools in place and money put in before the judiciary even gets involved.
Now, you wrote a book, and in it you have some rules that help you navigate through the world. Which of those rules, if any, do you turn to when you have been sentencing people?
I've turned to a couple of them. One is the technical violation rules. Whenever you get to court, you often find that the defendant tries to, and partly because he's just trying to stay out of jail, and I understand that, but mitigate his responsibility and doesn't understand his responsibility. Yes, I hit him, but do you know what he said to me? And that's being technical about it, just saying, well, technically, it's somebody else's fault. It's a need to take responsibility for everything you do. You can get called every name in the book. It does not require you to respond, because once you have, you've handed over your life to a person who sought to hurt you. That's the number one thing issue that I used to try to get across to my defendants about. They have a sense of lack of control that is erroneous.
Now, how has it felt when you have sentenced someone and that person then shows up again a few wrinkles later, or, you know, a scar or scarring experience later, and you see the same person going through the system more than once?
In the beginning, you think, I failed. And then afterwards, once you see so many people come back, recidivism, I got anxious and started doing other things, started looking at other alternatives and doing alternative programs. And also it made me go to high schools and deal with people before they ever came to the system. But when you see a person come back a second time, you know, you have a different discussion. I usually gave an opportunity the first time, a little bit of jail, a whole lot of probation, a whole lot of conditions, and a warning, if I see you again, I'm not playing with you, you just go, as a, you know, an incentive to work with me. But it's frustrating, it's hurtful, especially when you are a black woman like I am and saw so many young 18, 19, 20-year-old black men keep going back, just nickel and diming their way into felonies. It's a frustration about the systemic problems over which you have very little, if any, control.
Have you ever had a point in your life when you said, you know what, I made a mistake. I should have had a lighter sentence, or I should have given a heavier sentence?
Absolutely, all the time, because I review what I did, and I think every judge should do that. And to the extent that you acknowledge error, you grow and you learn. I hoped that I was a better judge at the end of those 12 years than I was at the beginning, and I always review what I did. I used to discuss my sentences with domestic violence defendants, with the domestic violence organization,
yeah.
Right, to say, what did you think of that? You know, what is your take on it? Because they used to sit in the courtroom, so I can understand how I can best create the resolution that I wanted, which was him to come out or him to stop doing what he was doing. So absolutely, all the time, inevitably, and you're not a good judge if you don't.
And just quickly, when you think about the experience that you've had, what's one thing that you would want people to know who are facing a charge, one thing that they can carry into court with them?
Learn. Go there and understand what it is you did wrong. Don't try to blame the system or the victim or whatever, even if it was a deluge of circumstances. Find out what your role is, because that's your life. And until you know your role, you don't control. And until you control, you can't stay away.
That's words to the wise right there. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Judge Lynn Toler is the star of the nationally syndicated TV show Divorce Court. She's also the author of My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. And she joined us from the studios of KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Diane Reeves is a force to be reckoned with. She has an international reputation and following, and she is the only singer to win Grammy Awards in a vocal category for 3 consecutive recordings. Reeves won a whole new set of fans on her on-screen role in the 2005 film Good Night and Good Luck. NPR's Tony Cox spoke with Reeves about her new album, When You Know. She started by talking about the influence her talented family's had on her. Her cousin is the musician George Duke, who also produced her album.
Music, I learned at that time, was more than just entertainment, but it was also a way of life and a means of communication, and it was something that brought the family together. It was just a very, very powerful, unifying force.
Packing my grip, and I'm taking a trip out of town over the weekend. Must have a change from the sight of this strange, lonely town over the weekend.
Eclectic is the word that I would use to describe your discography. You've sung all kinds of music, jazz, Latin, classical, world music. Talk about that kind of experimentation, why you went into it, and what it has done for your career, or perhaps to your career.
I think that all of that music is a part of my soul, you know. And for me, it's all one thing. It's just a different way of expressing it. One of my greatest talents, I think, is that, that I'm a kind of chameleon, you know, that I love all kinds of different things. And I found that, you know, the world of music is so vast and so broad, but at the same time, it's easy to find parts of yourself in places that you wouldn't even think that you were, you know. Mm-hmm. So all of those things are very much a part of what I do, and I love that. And I kind of got licensed to do that from people like George Duke and other great jazz artists who are out there that have the ability to do so many different things. I think jazz is the foundation for a lot of great musicians. And then after that, you know, it's this broad expression of things that really have influenced and addressed your life.
I can't explain the silver rain that found me, or was that a moon? Was that a nightingale?
Let's talk about the new CD, When You Know. I want to ask you a question about it, but let me set it up this way, because these are some of the track titles. I'm going to read them. And apparently there's a theme to this CD, and I want you to help us identify it after I read the song titles to see if there's a clue there for the audience. So here they are. The songs are Just My Imagination, Over the Weekend, Loving You, I'm in Love Again, Once I Loved You, Social Call, and Today Will Be a Good Day. Diane, I'm just not sure what the theme is here exactly. What is it?
Well, I think the obvious theme is love, you know, but they're love in different kinds of ways. But more than anything, it's a journey. I mean, you said Just My Imagination and Loving You. Those are songs from my youth. Those are songs that really bring back memories of a lot of things in a time when I was young, and, you know, and innocent and green and fresh and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, not knowing a lot of things about the world, but learning through song, you know, things about the world. And the music progresses, and the song like Windmills of Your Mind is just that representation of that flood of memories and feelings and emotions that I've had throughout the years. But it was really sobering after we did it, because it was kind of cathartic in a certain way, and in a lot of ways it made me see, wow, there were a lot of seeds that were planted then that have, you know, been very, very fruitful now in my life. And so the songs take on the feeling of a journey, and when they listen to the songs, they'll hear different parts of different songs in, you know, other songs. So I pull all of the story together by doing that, by quoting things like at the end of Just My Imagination, I say, in the windmills of my mind, I think about him all the time. There's a connection with all the music. And in the very last song, well, the record is called When You Know, and I love that song, When You Know, because that's a something you heard all your life, when you know that you know that you know, you know. But and then the last song is Today Will Be a Good Day. And for me, that's the ultimate. It's a song that I wrote for my mother, and it's a song that really represents positivity and optimism.
I got myself a good day. I'm gonna make it that way.
you also appeared in a documentary on the life of the legendary composer and pianist Billy Strayhorn.
Yes.
Now, his music, if I can say so, seems to me to really fit your style because you have such a smooth, silky, rich voice. How special was the artistry of Billy Strayhorn to you?
Oh, extremely special because, you know, it was interesting. He wrote beautiful, beautiful music, music that you want to play the melody. You don't want to do a variation on a theme. You just want to really savor the melody within these amazing harmonic structures because he was masterful at that. But his lyrics sometimes, a lot of them are so sad and they're longing for a lot of things. And when they told his story in the documentary, I really, really understood why he wrote the kind of words that he did or why the kind of words that were in his songs appeared because there was this part of him that was not fulfilled. And you actually can hear it in the melody, but more than anything, you hear it in the lyrics. But his music is very important to jazz music because of its structure. It's always fresh when people learn his music. It's something that always stays new and wonderful.
You were born in Detroit. You've lived in L.A. You live in Denver. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where else you have lived.
New York. I lived in New York.
What's your favorite place?
Where I am. I love Denver. You know, when I left home, I said, I'm never coming back here, you know, but then I was 18 years old. And I lived in Los Angeles for a long time. And in a lot of ways, I felt like I lived in my car. But that's where, you know, a lot of things began. And then I moved to New York, and that was absolutely wonderful. You know, a lot of energy here. And then I moved back to L.A. and I decided I'm going back to Denver. And I've been there ever since and I love it.
Diane Reeves, it's wonderful talking to you. I guess it is true. When you know, you know. Right?
That's right. When you know.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with jazz singer Diane Reeves. Her new CD, When You Know, comes out next week.